The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3389, Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney, I will move that House File 3389 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have an amendment that should be in your packet.
Representative Mahoney.
And if the chair would be so kind as to move that?
I will move the amendment. It is the A1 amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And we'll put the amendment on for the author. Representative Mahoney, is there anything that's controversial here, or what are we doing, just cleaning up?
Mr. Chair, committee members, there is really nothing altogether that controversial. We are changing an office in the Department of Employment and Economic Development to an authority so that we can take advantage of offers from some of the executives and people who own and run companies in the state based in science and technology.
All right. Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mahoney, two-year bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House File 3389 establishes, as I said, the Minnesota Science and Technology Economic Development Authority. Its purpose is to help develop a technology-based economic development strategy and guide for the state of Minnesota. Which would develop itself over investments and incentive programs that Minnesota might use to make itself more competitive. As I said, it appeals the Office of Science and Technology and establishes the Science and Technology Authority, and it's patterned after the Public Facilities Authority. The authority is governed by a commission made up of the Commissioner of Deed, Management and Budget, Revenue, Finance, and Ag. And one of the reasons in your packet you should have the recommendations of the Science and Technology Initiative reported to the legislature this year. In that initiative, they recommended a private-led authority. Unfortunately, the state of Minnesota has laws that do not allow private citizens to expend tax dollars. So we have structured this bill to have the commissioners as the authority, and these other members, which is later in the bill, as an advisory board. There is no cost. The existing funding from the Office of Science and Technology will be transferred to the authority. This is something that I'm not sure if in your package you have the list of other states that have authorities like this. But I will just use a couple of the most prominent ones. Ohio has one. They invested $681 million over the last 8 or 9 years and have generated $6.6 billion. Oklahoma Center for Advancement of Science and Technology has seen a $18 to $1 investment return on investment. This cornerstone of our future economy is based in science and technology. We are never going to go back to making widgets as a huge part of our economy. Science-based jobs typically pay about $66,000 a year. Those are the kind of jobs we really want to go after. Minnesota lags in its commercialization of research and development in the technology-based economic development. And Minnesota's business startup rate continues to be below national averages. We hope this Science and Technology Authority will be a step in the right direction to make it a better avenue. I can go through the bill if you like. It's a lot of, I don't want to say boilerplate, but it's mostly just technical, trying to get the authority made. On page 3 of the bill, it goes over what the duties of the Science and Technology Authority shall be. coordinating efforts with the private industry, promoting contractual relationships between Minnesota's businesses and federal grants, developing a framework for Minnesota's companies to establish sole source relationships with federal agencies, assisting the commercialization. And on page 4, subdivision 8, I'm hoping I'm on getting these pages correct. It gives a much shorter version of what they will be dealing with. Lines 416 through 420. Yeah, 420. High-tech research and development, product and process innovation, high-tech manufacturing, science and technology, business environment. On page 5, you have the makeup of the advisory board, which is two representatives of the University of Minnesota selected by the president, including faculty members actively involved in science and technology, representatives from the Minnesota State Colleges, chief executive of Mayo or a designee, six chief executive officers of science-based companies, four from science oriented, technology-oriented organizations, organized labor, venture capitalists, angel investors, and again, the rest of it is how they dispense money and how they accept money. Gives the legal authority to not interfere with contracts. And I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any questions to the bill? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think when I look at this, there are a lot of good things that I see in here, and certainly we want to focus on having that. But one of the questions that leads you to is I see a lot of authority here, set and collect fees. You can sue and be sued from this, that they can apply for, accept, and disperse gifts, grants, loans, or other property from the United States, the state, private sources, or any other source. Very broad, sweeping authority is in this. First of all, since this is to be replacing something else, is this what the previous entity, the not quite sure, Office of Science and Technology, can you kind of compare those two in regards to this broad sweeping authority?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, this authority is based on the Public Facilities Authority. The collecting fees, the suing and being sued are pretty much boilerplate taken out of that language. It says that, could you give me the page where you found some of these? And I,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, on page 3, subdivision 4 and 5, and on page 4, subdivision 7.
Yes.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, the commercialization assistance, I think, is what you're talking about. And that phase one small business, the SBIR and STTR are all things that this particular office does at this time. They go out and help companies, assist companies get these particular grants from the federal government. The power to sue and enter contracts, as I'm under the impression or the understanding, is that this is pretty standard for this type of an organization. They have the right to be sued if they do something wrong as an authority, and to sue if a contract is broken. Now, I can certainly be corrected if staff has a different understanding of that, and I have Department of Economic Development and Employment and Economic Development here to answer questions if I'm too far off.
Representative Murrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I know that there's a disinclination to expand advisory boards. I'm looking at page 5. And in situations especially involving science and technology, I would at least invite you to consider adding one more member from the Minnesota Private College Council. I think we tend to just think of the U and MinSCU as being our higher ed sources, but I would argue that the privates might also have some helpful advice and insight.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, I can certainly look at that. I'm not opposed to being inclusive, I'm trying to keep this a workable size.
Any further discussion? Representative Mahoney, you have anyone else that needs to testify today?
Mr. Chair, I know you have a full agenda. I have a half a dozen people here willing to testify, but I told them I think we can get this through without any testimony.
All right. Seeing no other testimony, I will renew my motion that House File 3389 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Representative Bigham. House File 3106. I will move House File 3106, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to Civil Justice. And members, we have a memo in our packet narrowing down the discussion in this committee. So if we could take a look at that section of the bill. We don't need the entire bill before us today. So, Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if I've told you lately how proud I am.
Representative, excuse me. Mr. Shepard wants to add one more section.
Okay.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, when I prepared this memo outlining the sections of the bill that are relevant to the committee's jurisdiction, I omitted one section, and that is on page 6 of the bill, the very top of the page, which relates to rulemaking, and there's a related provision to that on the very end of the bill. I apologize for omitting that from the memo.
All right. Okay. With that, Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if I've told you lately how proud I am that Winona State is my alma mater, and I am sporting my Winona State pin just for you today, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment, the A14 amendment, that is extremely technical. It was a misnumbering of subdivisions, I guess, in drafting, so if I could have that move so it could get
will,
in the order.
I'll move the A14 amendment. And any discussion to the A14? Wait, hold it. We're still fixing.
Okay.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, we found one other technical correction that would be desirable just shortly before the meeting. And with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, it's one word, basically. Right. It would be page 14, line 15, after 4, comma, where it says subdivision 4, comma, insert paragraph A.
Members, everybody have it? Mrs. Anderson, you have it? Okay. Representative, but you obviously know about the change?
Yes.
All right. I'll incorporate that into this amendment, the A14 amendment. And with that, any further discussion to the A14 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. All right. To the bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Folks and members, this is the DWI ignition lock proposal initiative that is going through the process. I do have Commissioner Campion here and many of his able staff to explain the bill, but as you heard from the chair, I think we're focused today on the rulemaking. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Pat McCormick from the Department of Motor Vehicles, and if there are any other questions regarding the bill, we do have staff here.
All right. Where's Mr. McCormick? Oh, Ms. McCormick. I'm sorry. Sorry, I'm thinking of another McCormick, but that's all right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Division Director for Driver and Vehicle Services with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And as Representative Bigham said, we're going to just be, and as you requested, we're just going to be discussing the rulemaking provisions within this legislation. And the first rulemaking that was discussed was the one that would start on page 7. And that one talks about the fact that the department would have the authority to impose, it would be page 6, section 7, And it talks on there at the top of the page about the commissioner shall establish performance standards and the process for certifying chemical monitoring devices. And these rules are exempt from Chapter 14. And the purpose of the department working on the draft with the legislative sponsors to exempt this process from rulemaking is because we will be taking care of trying to work out the performance standards and the process for certifying the devices in the contract process, because we would have to, and procurement process, which is a public process. So the department believes that those certification standards and performance standards will be included in the RFP process for contracts with vendors that would work with the the violators in order to be able to get them on the ignition interlock. And so we believe that that process would result in making sure that people understand and have public awareness as to what our standards are and what the procedures would be for certification of the ignition interlock devices. In addition to that, as we've heard in testimony throughout the legislative process with this bill, a lot of concerns have been raised that there's new technologies out there and that the hope that the department would be open to utilizing those technologies. Some of the ones they've talked about are ignition interlock with cameras in the car. Another one is that's being worked on is the use of biometrics in terms of starting a car with ignition interlock. And so those would be changing technologies that would be able to be handled much more easily through a contract and RFP process. In addition, there are rules on page 13, line rulemaking authority, and page 13, lines 33 through 14.2. And those rules also get into establishing the performance standards again, and also talk about the fact that there will be, as part of the certification, there will be a form that will be filled out and as prescribed by the commissioner. And also we'll talk about the fact that there will have to be monitoring to indigent participants at a discounted rate. And then finally on page 14, there's rulemaking again, and that rulemaking deals with the department being able to look at the rehabilitation requirements and be able to, some of those rehabilitation requirements are in this bill, and others will be changed based on the DL Sanctions Committee's recommendations, and we would then be able to amend the current rules that DVS uses in terms of rehabilitation requirements. The department had an 18-month committee with the DL Sanctions Group. We had over 62 participants and stakeholders, public and private, that are involved in the process that made these recommendations. We believe it has been a public process, and certainly we, the department, would be willing to make a good cause argument as to why we would be making those changes if this was adopted.
Questions? Representative Kiffmeyer, question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Is this question to this particular witness or to the bill?
Well, we're trying to focus on the Shepherd memo, if we can, and yeah, on those parts of the bills that deal with rulemaking. So if we could focus on that first. Seeing none, then Representative Kiffmeyer to the bill in general, but I would hope that we could keep it somewhat confined here. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to Section 11, I've just noticed here, I know that this is a tougher way of looking at these things and a preventive way to prevent accidents, to prevent those things, and I'm really appreciative of that. I think that's a really important approach to take here. But Section 11 seems to soften things under other waiting periods. There may be a reason or context. I would just like to see if you might comment on that particular section, because it, moving it from a second violation to third, and from a third to fourth, and you know, with some of these other things. So maybe in context, this would be just fine.
Representative Bigham, do you have someone else who wishes to testify to that?
Yep.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Kiffmeyer, I'll have Gene Ryan from the department come up.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gene Ryan. I'm from the Office of Traffic Safety within the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think that the question is we're reducing the waiting time periods for getting on ignition interlock. I believe that is your question, and they are greatly reduced. And what we're finding as through our committee process is that there was a lot of people that during that hard revocation, that time period of not allowing for any driving, people were driving anyways. So what we're hoping to do is encourage people to install an ignition interlock device on their car, which we know is effective in reducing impaired driving and will actually create safer roadways if they get the device installed on their car instead of driving illegally and most possibly driving impaired because they have the ability to still get behind the wheel of the vehicle and drive after drinking. This will actually encourage people to drive legally and safely.
Okay. Further discussion. Representative Kiffmeyer. No? All right. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It was mentioned that technology is always improving and such, and I notice the effective date is August 1st, and depending on the bill's fate and schedule, is that a realistic goal to expect that this could be implemented?
Who wishes to reply? Mrs. McCormick? Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, reason we're using that effective date for rulemaking is so that we can get the process started so that we would be we would have the rulemaking begin, and the contract process begin, and that will take some time for us to do in order to be able to get the program implemented. And we also have a pilot project that's in place right now with ignition interlock, so we'll be done with that, and we'll be able to ramp up to be able to have the certification and performance standards developed by then.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, I believe that Section 14.386 is, I suppose, one could term the super expedited rulemaking process. And one of the reasons for paragraph B is that in using that process, there is put in law a necessity to revisit that. And yet I see that you're not only asking for super expedited rulemaking, but then you are eliminating the requirement that any rules created under this process expire after 2 years, so that there is, the time to review. Why are you asking for the exemption from the 2-year expiration?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, the department believes that we will still be making public any changes that would occur in terms of the certification and performance standards, because we will have a contract process and those contracts are public. And so we would still, any changes that were made, any different technologies that were used, that would all be through a public and contract process. And so those will all be public documents. And as I did state earlier, that the department is willing to, if necessary, develop a good cause exemption if that would be necessary and the legislature would want us to do so. But we believe that this process has been public in terms of working with stakeholders, and it will continue to be as we move forward with the program.
Representative
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, I, I understand that you know, we're trying to get things moving, get things in place, all right? But when you are using the supercharged rulemaking, and we're talking very specific about the section in the bill that says if rules are created, so we're not talking about the certification piece that you specifically exempt and say aren't rules. We're not talking about the standards, which you say aren't rules, but there is a section in this bill that says we may be able to write rules, all right? And now rules have the force of law, and you're going to use a supercharged process to create these rules that have the force of law, and yet you are exempting something that the legislature, I think, very thoughtfully put into place, that any rules created under this process expire after 2 years. And 2 years should be plenty of time to turn a rule, which has the force of law, into a law which should have the force of law as well.
Is McCarthy on to say anything, or just let that stand?
Mr. Chair, I have no additional comments.
Okay. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that House File 3106 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Dill is having a medical procedure today, so Representative Saylor is going to fill in for him on House File 3124. Representative Saylor, I'll move that House File 3124 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. And members, in the memo that you have in your packet, we're going to try to confine our comments to those sections of the bill that are directly related to this committee. And Representative Saylor, I think you have a copy of the memo. So, Representative Saylor, thank you for filling in today. And why don't you go over those sections that are in the purview of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The provisions in this bill that pertain to this committee are basically some DNR provisions. I do have a testifier from DNR if there are additional questions. But Section 4 basically just pertains to prescribing some alternative testing time periods and methods for some fish testing. And Section 12 is just establishing fees for the duck stamp, you know, pictorial migratory waterfowl stamps, requiring that it does not recover significantly more or less than the cost of producing and mailing the stamps. Section 29 refers to the taking of elk that are causing damage or nuisance. Section 36 streamlines the process, giving the DNR more time to make some decisions on slot limits. Section 38 authorizes the DNR to prohibit transportation of live fish if VHS is established in the state. And Section 43 authorizes the DNR to use good cause rulemaking to amend the rules to allow a person to take fish by spearing on Cass Lake.
Discussion to those sections of the bill. Seeing no discussion, is there anyone that wishes to testify to those sections? All right, then I'll renew my motion that House File 3124 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Dietrich, House File 3475. Representative Dietrich, the first motion is going to be that House File 3475 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to environmental policy. You have quite a trek in front of you, and there are a number of different committees that want to see this bill. Then, Representative Dietrich, I believe you have some amendments.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have the DE1 amendment, the delete everything. And on the delete everything amendment, I have a verbal amendment, one small word, and it is on page 7. Line 1, it reads, the board shall consist of seven members, and we need to insert the word appointed. Appointed by the governor.
Mr. Shepherd, that works? All right. What I'm going to do with this amendment hasn't been moved, so Mr. Shepherd, I'm just going to incorporate that into the amendment, and then you have no other changes to the amendment?
Correct.
Then I'll move the DE1 amendment with that incorporation in it. So let's get the bill in the order that the author wishes to have it. All those in favor of adopting the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right, Representative Dietrich, you have a slightly changed bill here. So why don't you tell us what's been changed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As members recall, I was here on Thursday with this bill, and there were some concerns brought up from the government, obviously, operational standpoint of the function of the bill. And so, Mr. Chairman, you asked that I work with members on their concerns and come back with a delete everything, and that is what I have done. I have taken the advice of the members in consultation with Mark Shepherd, and what has evolved is the DE1 amendment. The overall principle of the bill has not changed. We are creating a lands manager and creating an independent agency for that lands manager to manage. And that is the crux of the bill. The pieces that have changed, though, from the major pieces in regards to government operations that have changed in regards to the bill, is we responded to Representative Kahn's concerns about rulemaking, and with the advice of Representative Winkler and Mark Shepherd, we have eliminated the rulemaking piece, believing that there is no need for this person to have the ability to rulemake. What we have also done is we have simplified the appointments of the membership of the board, and we have also simplified the nomination process for the board of directors. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask Mark Shepherd to go through the other pieces of the bill, the major changes.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that Representative Dietrich has accurately described the major policy changes. That perhaps the biggest one was, as Representative Dietrich indicated, the you may recall the original bill had a lot of detail regarding the nominating committee, and Representative Dietrich has changed that quite a bit so that it's simpler. There also was a more of a complex process for appointment of the director, and Representative Dietrich's amendment has changed that and made it a more traditional process to be appointed by the board. There's also been some other technical language added that is sort of the standard language for appointments of board members. And I think Representative Dietrich has accurately portrayed the major changes, the policy changes in this amendment.
I have one individual that wishes to testify. It's Dr. Chaplin. And if he'd like to come up. Now, did you see the amendment? So you know that you're testifying to a changed bill.
No, I haven't seen the amendment.
I think you might want to, unless it's just on the general concept of this, but the bill has been changed rather significantly. So.
Well, this is...
Go ahead. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Steve Chaplin. I'm the senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy. There are two issues in this bill that I think are probably still in the amendment and are still pertinent, but correct me if I'm wrong as I go through this. The mission of the Nature Conservancy is to preserve the plants, animals, and natural communities that represent the biodiversity of the earth by protecting the lands and waters they need to survive. It's that mission that is prompting me to come and address two issues on this bill. The first is that there are very important conservation lands included within the state school trust lands. At the time the state school trust lands were set aside, there were a lot of natural communities, including old growth forests, that were very common within this state. But after 120 years of development, a lot of those lands no longer exist, a lot of those natural community types. And so they are much more significant now than when the lands were originally set aside. To illustrate, old growth forest, there are about 17,300 acres of old growth forest on school trust lands. About 37% of all of the old growth that occurs on state lands within the state, which is about all of the state, all the old growth forest that there is in the state. In addition, there is about 280,000 acres of high and outstanding biodiversity significant lands on the within school trust lands as identified by the Minnesota County Biological Survey. Now, what we feel is that it's important to maintain the sound natural resource conservation and management principles as called for in current law. If these lands are managed in the most profitable manner possible, it could jeopardize the important natural communities found on them. And so this is, I think, one consideration that needs to be taken into account as we figure out what the future of school trust land should be. The second issue that I'd like to look at is the biological management expertise located within the DNR, especially for rare and significant community types. We have some of the best managers in the country within the Division of Ecological Resources and Division of Forestry on having knowledge about how to best protect and manage these rare resources. Separating the management and oversight into a separate agency of these school trust lands from the knowledge base in the DNR will make the proper conservation management that much more difficult to accomplish. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, those are the issues that I would like to bring to your attention.
Yeah, Dr. Chaplin, I appreciate you coming today, and I think you might want to repeat that testimony at the next committee also. Right. And before you leave today, make sure you get a copy of the Delete Everything Amendment. Your points probably still stand, but I think you're going to be with Representative Dietrich for a while, as this bill presents.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I want to thank Representative Dietrich for the taking up the cause of this important issue. I actually think that most folks in the legislature probably don't understand school trust lands very well, and the I think required reading for this body and the Senate should be the 1784 land ordinance that establishes school trust lands more broadly. These are lands that are held in trust to designate a funding stream and assets to ensure education of the next generation. So I just want to thank you for that issue. I think that you have some environmental issues to continue to address that I'd like to continue speaking with you about before you get to the next committee that the previous testifier spoke to a little bit. But I want to focus on the governance. And I appreciate you working with Representative Winkler to change the nomination process for the board. One question I have, I think it may be for Mr. Shepard, is in setting up the initial seven-member board, if you turn to page 7, paragraph B, it's clear that there are, that paragraph to me is clear of the six members serving one six-year, five-year, four-year, three-year, two-year, one-year term, respectively. And I'm wondering, Mr. Shepard, if it's clear in the language, it's not clear to me that seventh member is appointed under paragraph D by the governor.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Dietrich, I believe that's correct, that the seventh member would be appointed and serve at the pleasure of the governor. Unlike the other members who have six-year terms.
And
Representative Kalin.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Shepard, then, is that seventh member always appointed by the governor and serving at the pleasure of the governor?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin and Representative Dietrich should please correct me if I misunderstand her intent, but I believe that is the case, that the seventh member would always be appointed by and serve at the pleasure of the governor.
Representative Kalin.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Shepard, is this, my understanding just from speaking with Representative Winkler informally was that the goal was to mirror the Minsky trustees format. Is this the same process for the Minsky trustees?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that the general outline of the process under which there's a nominating committee mirrors the Minsky Board of Trustees. I don't think offhand that, I don't know that there's a seventh, an extra member on the Minsky Board that serves at the pleasure of the governor. I'd have to look that up.
And then Mr. Chair,
Kalin.
I think the question would be then for Representative Dietrich if she could articulate why this particular, why having six members of this board be appointed by the governor with the consent of the Senate, and then having one member that serves at the pleasure, and I actually point to that there may be a contradiction in language on line 7.1, which now reads that the board consists of seven members appointed by the governor with the consent of the Senate, while that seventh member under paragraph D appears to be serving at the pleasure of the governor. But I wonder if Representative Dietrich just comment generally.
Respond to that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess when I first looked at it, I did not see the conflict there. But as you're bringing that up, that might be there might need to be just a little bit of clarification there. I am wondering if. Well, let me just speak to it in general. We thought that it was important to give the governor that level of decision-making and authority for one member of the board, and so that was the point of view. And what's your... Are you questioning why the governor should have that authority?
Mr. Chair...
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, yes, without the... without the consent of the Senate for when we're managing lands under governance by the board themselves, not by the DNR and other areas, and I think we've seen enough controversial issues related to land management that I just want to be very clear about why we're making choices to manage this land in a specific way and who's going to have input and an open process to managing those lands.
Representative Dietrich.
Well, I guess just in principle, we thought that it was important that the governor have that level of buy-in. You know, he is the one who is going to be there for the next 4 years, and he is on the, and he is also charged with the responsibility of the fund and making sure that the money gets to the schools. So I guess he is the governor. I guess is my most simple answer.
All right, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dietrich, for your work on this, helping to explain to me what your intentions are and what you're doing, and to Representative Winkler for the amendment. I still have a concern based a little bit on the testimony we heard earlier, and you had pointed out that in our conversation that this was done way back when at statehood, and at statehood we didn't have the same kinds of concerns we do now about the boundary waters, old growth forests, as was mentioned. And I guess I need a little bit more comfort in terms of, will this bill affect in any way the provision, I guess, in 127A31, sound natural resource conservation and management principles? Is there any comfort you can give me about that piece of state law? I know you said this new commission will follow state law. This is in state law. Any worries about this that we may have?
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hornstein, I'm glad that you asked that question. In the bill on page 8 and on page 5, both places we reference that the trust will need, the management of the trust lands will need to balance the short-term and long-term interests, and that the long-term benefits are not lost in the effort to maximize short-term gains. And then again on page 5, we have language, intentional language, to also alleviate the environmental concerns. And that is on page 5, as I said, line 29. And once again, it says that requires the balancing of the short-term and the long-term interests so that long-term benefits are not lost in the effort to maximize short-term gains. The people from Utah, and as you know, this piece of legislation was modeled after what the Utah model does. They have a lands manager. The lands manager for Utah was just here, and with the time that I have spent with him, actually he says he has commented that they actually have more land now in wilderness than they did when he started. So it isn't what some people have this perception of it. It's how you manage the land. Sometimes it's how you swap the land. Which lands do you sell? How do you preserve those lands? But I want to just make very clear that the legislative auditor's report discussed the Minnesota Constitutional Study Commission report, and it concluded that school trust lands should be managed in the interest of the trust beneficiaries, and those are the school districts, and this is supposed to provide a long-term, forever funding stream for our schools. And that a lands manager or somebody in the state needs to be looking at the land, determining which land needs to be preserved, and then how do we either swap it, trade it, sell it, in order to help generate revenue for the schools. It doesn't necessarily mean, it doesn't at all mean take the land and do something totally different with it.
Representative Dietrich, I think the department wants to comment on this, so welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I know you have a lot of bills before you today. I just want to focus on one section of the bill that is directly related to your committee here, and it would be Section 20 on page 10, the transfer of state and staff and assets and budget responsibility from the department to this new commission. The school trust lands that the state manages are parcelized 40s, 120s. It's not like we have 100,000 acres of school trust fund land forest or anything like that. Our staff works daily on a piece of state forest land, piece of tax forfeit land, a piece of school trust land. So now we will need to create, if we're transferring the staff that's working on school trust fund lands, we're going to have to backfill our state foresters, our lands and minerals staff. Or we're going to have to figure out how to do this. It might be best to have this new entity, if the legislature wants to create it, contract with the department for those staffs. But for us to transfer our assets and equipment directly associated with the management of all permanent school trust fund lands to this new entity, it will be a shift of a large part of our workforce. So that's one of our concerns. We need to work with Representative Dietrich on this bill as it moves forward throughout the committees. If the legislature's desire is to maximize revenue for the trust, then I think you folks need to look at 127.31, which directs us to manage these lands with environmentally sound benefits, because there are conflicts that occur on a daily basis, and we try to manage those accordingly. We work with the Permanent School Trust Fund Advisory Committee closely, that has been revamped or re-energized, if you want to call it, in past years, to include many of the people that would be on this board to make these decisions and provide us recommendations. So if this entity is created, Mr. Chair, members, we respectfully request not to transfer our staff, but to figure out how that work would be done to avoid duplication of effort and hiring of staff that I think we all know the state just can't afford right now.
I'm going to focus on the testifier for now. So Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I understand and appreciate why no agency wants to reduce its staff and its kind of footprint in state government, but what exactly is the harm to the public in the fact that your agency would be a little bit smaller? I understand why people in the DNR don't want to be smaller and have less authority and have less of an impact, but why should the public care whether you have fewer employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, we do have fewer employees. We will have fewer employees in the future. The budget proposals that are going through both bodies take over $1 million each from the Department of Forestry. What I'm saying is, how does the state effectively manage both trust fund land and state forest land to maximize economic benefit, to also provide reducing fire threat and safety out there? If you don't manage the forest properly, we increase the threat to health and safety through fire dramatically. So I'm just talking about the most effective way to do this is not to transfer the DNR staff working on trust fund lands to this entity, and then we'll have nobody to do forestry work ourselves.
The same people who work on the state forest lands on a daily basis are the ones who work on the permanent school trust fund lands on a daily basis. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Representative Kalin, and this is to the testifier.
It is, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, I appreciate the overall sort of structural concern you're raising. I think that this issue has to get worked out. In terms of us being aware of this provision in the bill and the power that and expense that the new board could have, my concerns are assuaged by two things. One is the effective date of July 2013. So we're talking about two biennia from now. So the 14-15 fiscal budgets. I do think that one of the questions that will have to be resolved in the Environment Committee will be this issue about what to do between now and then, and how to skillfully and artfully manage that transition. You do raise a good point that I think most folks are not aware of, that we have gone from having 1/36 of our land contiguously be the school trust land to dividing and not quite conquering. But I'm assuaged by the delay, as well as the fact that I know that that you will be able to work this out both in the bill if necessary for the short term, but also working with the board as it gets developed. So I appreciate bringing the concern. My fears are assuaged for now.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This testimony actually kind of raises the issue to me, and I wonder if Mr. Shepard could just review the constitutional provision that's at issue and that the OLA was reviewing, because I want us to be clear about what the obligations, what obligations we have with respect to the beneficiaries and so forth, because, you know, it may be more efficient for the DNR to manage all these lands, but if there's an inherent conflict in what goals they're trying to achieve, and there's a conflict with what the constitutional provision is, then I think we should have concerns about that.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, and members, as all of you know, the Permanent School Trust Fund is created in the Minnesota Constitution. It's Article 11, Section 8, and while it specifies what lands are part of those trusts, and then specifies that the fund would be invested to secure the maximum return consistent with maintenance of the perpetuity, does not prevent the sale of investments at less than cost of the fund, some other investment language, and then says the net interests and dividends arising from the funds shall be distributed to the different school districts of the state in a manner prescribed by law. So I think that's the key part, is the school districts being mentioned in the Constitution.
Mr. Chair, I guess my point there is that you mentioned two things. One is that it's supposed to be maximized for dollars being moved to the schools as much as possible. And to the extent we're inserting a conservation purpose into these lands, it's at the expense of the schools and the kids. And secondly, the other piece I heard there is that they're supposed to maintain this into perpetuity. In other words, to look out both for the short and the long-term interest. And I think that's, if any place, where the conservation element comes in. So I think if we have a situation where we have an agency that is mixing its conservation goals with the goals that are set forth in the Constitution for the school trust lands, that's a conflict that should be separated out of the agency.
Mr. Myers.
Mr. Chair, members, it's not the agency mixing its goals. It's the agency meeting the legislative intent of the law that we're trying to manage. If the language in 127.8.31 were eliminated, we would maximize the revenue. There would be different logging practices on school trust fund lands than any other lands that we have. They would be managed for highly intensive timber management. We would be looking for larger, more productive mineral deposits. Maybe some more mining would occur, a lot more mining would occur if we weren't trying to balance that environmental aspect. We've sold off most of the productive school trust lands already. We have 2.5 million acres of forestry land, of which 800,000 acres are swamp. So we have 1.3 million acres, roughly, of commercial forest land. That is not the most productive forest land in the state. So it's maximizing the revenue while trying to maintain the legislative intent of economic sound management is where the DNR is at right now, meeting the letter of the law. If the law changes, we will manage those lands accordingly, Mr. Chair.
All We're still going to focus on the testifier, so Representative Hornstein for the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just to follow up then on your response, is there anything in this bill, you know, from the DNR's perspective that would change how these lands are managed in terms of conservation? And then, as you listed a number of things that were quite frightening in terms of scenarios that could take place if it was just an economic argument. Is there anything in this bill that you would have concerns about that would change the status quo?
Mr. Chair, members, just as I previously mentioned, the duplication of effort, trying perhaps if there was a state land forestry staff and a permanent school trust for land forestry staff, just those types of things, the effective administration of the two entities. The 127A.31 is not dealt with in this bill at this point in time. So at this point in time, the new board would have the same challenges that the department has right now, trying to provide for economic growth, recreation, and environmental protection.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Kalin.
And Mr. Chair, you know, Representative Hornstein and I share a lot of the same conservation values, environmental values. But I think that having reread the constitutional provision multiple times, including just 2 minutes ago, again, that these lands are dealt with separately and have a different purpose as set up by both the 1784 land ordinance and our constitution. And you know, I think that the DNR has recognized for quite a while that it is, while it may be good for the short run to, for instance, clear cut massive expanses of school trust land, that would not meet our constitutional duty to provide for the next generation of a fair education. And so I think that actually this board will struggle with these questions quite thoughtfully. And I think that the DNR is actually, well, I disagree with some ways the DNR has managed lands. I think that in general, that related to school trust lands, that they have been on the decent track. I think we can get them on an even better track with this bill. But I do think we have to make sure that the powers given to the board and the responsibilities do articulate some conservation ethic, but we have to live up to the true charge of the Constitution that these are resource lands for finances for our schools.
All right, members, I'm going to return to my list of individuals that wanted to talk, but Mr. Myers, you might want to stay close just in case.
Thank you.
Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. Some of the discussion's probably been made already, but just kind of backtracking this on my list on my paper here is on the top of page 7, you know, where we're looking at the appointments of 6-year terms. That seems kind of like an awful long time to have a appointee to be, and I don't know if that's the normal standard of 6 years on some of these appointees, or could it be down to 3 years or so. It just seems a lot of authority for an appointed board.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Sterner. I am open to discussion on that, but on the other hand, whoever is on this board has a very large responsibility in balancing the state's conservation environmental principles and along with their primary responsibility, and that is their obligation to the beneficiaries of this trust. And it is extremely complex. And I think that that it is actually a benefit to have someone who can look at the long term instead of the short term. And I think that alleviates some of what Representative Hornstein was talking about too. You want somebody with the long term view, not a short term view. Let's come in and I'm here for 2 years, so I'm going to try to make as much money as I possibly can. You definitely want the long term view.
Representative Stern.
And what kind of compensation would these board members get for being appointed to this position?
Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate it if Mr. Shepherd would address that.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, the compensation would be the same that is provided for other members of state boards, which I'll find it is a per diem of $55 a day plus expense reimbursement.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Shepherd.
Representative Stern.
Just maybe one more
wrap-up
quickly. But, yeah, just my, some of my concern is, you know, we're looking at possibly redesigning government. We have this large deficit and a structural imbalance going forward. It just seems like setting up another board. I have some concern, and I do have environmental concerns as well with the different management from our DNR. And also, I just think, you know, we also have a high level of administrative costs right now where it's well overstated, and that's a place where I think we could look at some, you know, trimming an ad, and this kind of creates more of an administrative nightmare. So I do have some concerns that way with this bill.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Stern, Representative Sterner. Actually, you made my point very well, and that is that that this that right now it is an administrative nightmare for our school trust lands. And I did not have any intention of getting into that because I really don't want to start blaming and finger-pointing. But when you look at the administrative costs of the DNR to manage our forest lands, I don't want to oversimplify the issue, but just for the sake of this discussion, because Mr. Meyer went there, he talks about duplication of effort. I think that there is already duplication of effort. The DNR's mission versus the mission of the lands dedicated to the schools, and when you look at administrative, first of all, the DNR has the ability through statute to deduct all of their expenses from the school trust land. There are people who believe that some of that land, that money that is deducted, furthers the statewide mission of conservation and environment as opposed to the school trust lands. Now, I don't believe that we ought to be charging our schools for the management costs of the DNR. And so you talk about this just being another agency. This is actually government redesign. This is taking a very small constitutional niche, and it is saying we are going to focus on that with one person responsible, with a board to oversee that person. And I just need to emphasize that there are no general fund monies that go towards this. The DNR deducts all of their expenses from the schools, the school trust fund, before it even gets to the fund. And this agency would also do the same. But it is my opinion that this is streamlining and redesigning government and going back to its original purpose. And if I need to just give one point. For example, in 2009, we have 2.5 million acres of forestry lands. The DNR deposited 200,000 into the permanent school advisory, into the permanent school fund. Now, and much of millions went to management and administration. Did the DNR lay off anybody in the school trust lands area? No. Did they cut back on any of their expenses when every single business, every single homeowner in this state has been cutting back or is flat in 2009? The answer was no. And I'll have that discussion all day, any day.
Great. Thank you, Representative Dietrich.
All right. Representative Kiffmeyer, while the clock says 5 to 8, the other clock says 9:33. We're going with the other one.
Mr. Chairman, Kiffmeyer. Thank you, Mr. I'll just go with your clock. All right. I have two questions here. One of them has to do with the proceeds of the trust fund land. And as I've read through this, and it's a particular area, the concern I have is, are there specific schools that benefit from this, or is this something that goes to all students equally across the state of Minnesota?
Representative
the proceeds from the lands get deposited into the school trust fund. That corpus fund generates interest and dividends. The interest and dividends is distributed to every pupil in the state equally. And last year, I don't remember if you were you here in 2008, we passed a law that said no longer can we continue to balance the budget off of the school children, and that money needs to go to the school children over and above education funding. And so we eliminated the subtraction. And in that, and last year, it was $34 per pupil to every student in the state.
Representative Kiff, my Representative Biskins has a comment to this.
Thank you. To that point, Representative Kiffmeyer, and I know that it is Representative Dietrich's intent that the proceeds are distributed equally to all public school children, but at this time and in this day, it is not, because it is not distributed to public school charter school students.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the reason for that is because in the Constitution it says that the money gets distributed to the school districts, and we distribute, the Department of Education distributes that on a per pupil basis.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We can follow up with that and get a little more information. The other thing is, in regards to the governance, I still have questions about that. And also the nominating committee mirrors the actual appointing process, so I'm not quite sure, you know, why you have both. But, Mr. Chairman, I know that you have other bills on the agenda, and so Representative Dietrich, this is a whole new amendment, so that changes what I might have thought of when you talked to me yesterday. So if we can just work together on some of that, if I could just maybe let it go for today and follow up with you. I don't know if that works.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I believe there will be a lot of work on this bill. And Representative Dietrich, I applaud the fact that you're emulating the appointment process of MNSCU, but I would caution you that MNSCU hasn't performed the way it was enacted either. So you might want to be a little careful about saying it's like MNSCU. Representative Hilty.
My question has been addressed, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn.
I'm not finished.
Any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And working with Mr. Shepard, I think we may have a short amendment that would resolve the question on that seventh member appointment. So,
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin and members, Representative Kalin suggested a change that would go on page 7, line 14 of the bill, and I do have this written down for Ms. Anderson. It would be page 7, line 14, after the word serves, insert a six-year term, comma, but may be removed. So the whole concept would be that the member serves a six-year term. It would be subject to consent of the Senate, but this one member could be removed at the pleasure of the governor.
Right. Representative Dietrich, so to that amendment.
I would consider that a friendly amendment.
All right. Representative Kalin.
I'll move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin moves the amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right. Discussion to the bill as amended. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify very briefly? One more person. All right. Very briefly. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
My name is Wayne Brandt. I'm Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries, and the Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Our members are loggers, truckers, paper mills, sawmills, engineered wood products manufacturers, and producers of renewable energy from forest biomass. So we spend a lot of money buying the rights to harvest timber on school trust lands and are deeply interested in this topic. I think in your discussion thus far today, you've identified the essential conundrum of a desire on the part of Representative Dietrich and the schools, school interests, to derive more income, I think both gross but particularly net, off of these lands, and a desire to have these lands provide other benefits, and those are not incompatible. Maximizing the revenues by setting up a new agency on each acre probably is incompatible, because you're not going to generate revenue off of old growth stands, but there's nothing wrong with condemning them through the trust and compensating the trust for those lands. I think the essential question in finding the balance on this issue is whether or not setting up a new agency is the most effective way to go. We have not, my organizations have not taken a position on this. We commend Representative Dietrich for highlighting this issue, which we've talked about for many years, and which has gotten precious little attention, but now I think it's going to get substantial attention. You know, we think that there can be a better job done either within a new agency or within the DNR to accomplish the goals. The question is which path to follow. And I would just note that as we look at the cost charged to the trust, the structural direction and imperative and incentives to the department come from the legislature. The legislature is the one that has set up a system where the school trust is the only entity of government in the state that's charged for fire suppression. We don't charge wildlife management areas. We don't charge SNAs. We don't charge state parks. We don't even charge the counties. But we charge the school children in this state. Highly inappropriate in our view. Clearly in these tight budget times, subsequent administrations, all three parties, I guess, there's a strong incentive to load costs against the trust. Legislation and statute allows that. So I think that there are a number of ways to increase revenue while doing sound natural resource management. I mean, I dare say that even industry lands aren't managed solely to maximize revenues. You know, we have set aside areas on industry lands and others. So I don't think that need be the concern that it's going to be solely to maximize. But I do think that there are changes to management and potentially changes to structure and policy that will allow greater deposits, net deposits, into the school trust fund to benefit the children of our state. And we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Dietrichs on this important issue. Thank you.
Representative Dietrich, is it today you have the people from Utah?
Yes. Here?
And what time is that?
Right now they are in education policy at 2:45. They are going to education finance. At noon they are going to the Senate Environment Committee. And they are at the Permanent School Advisory Committee meeting tonight at 6.
All right. Members may want to log on and take a look at the testimony from those committees, or when this committee ends, if they're still there, to sit in on those committee hearings. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you for bringing that up, Mr. Chair. At 10:30, I believe, there is an informal meet and greet with them. If anybody would be interested, they could see Grace Kelleher, and she is hosting them since I will be in Texas.
All right. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, renew my motion that House File 3475, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Environment Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank
Representative
you, Mr. Chairman.
Interesting. And in the first version, they needed unlimited rules-making ability, and now they need no ability. It's an interesting.
Representative Horns, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1828 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
All right. To that motion, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill comes to us from a variety of groups who were involved in both housing policy and the Metro Cities, which is a group that represents municipalities in the metropolitan area. And House File 1828 was first heard and passed unanimously by the local government division last year. So essentially, the bill accomplishes one goal, which is to amend the section of state law which says that an affordable housing development in a comprehensive plan needs to pass by two-thirds of the vote of the decision-making body, which in this case is usually a city council. And so that's essentially what this does. It says that affordable housing should be treated like any other land use change in municipal law. We have, for example, now Minneapolis is considering an amendment to an ordinance around a waste facility. That's a simple majority. So if a waste facility can be a simple majority, so should affordable housing. And I have one testifier, Kevin McHenry from Metro Cities.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Kevin McHenry from Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents 80 cities across the region at the Capitol and at the Met Council. We support House File 1828, which authorizes local governments to amend their comprehensive plans in order to facilitate increased lifestyle and affordable housing with a simple majority vote. This will maintain local control and will help cities avoid a potential roadblock in meeting their affordable housing goals. This is one of several proposals that are part of the Metro Cities policies on affordable housing. Comprehensive plans provide state, regional, and municipal governments with a rational and predictable plan for growth, development, and resource allocation, and they are updated every 10 years. In the current housing market and economy, those plans can become outdated before the 10-year time frame is up. Thank you for your time, and we'll stand for any questions.
All right, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein, I do support your bill. However, I would like to offer a brief oral amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beginning on page 1, line 14, through the remainder of the bill, delete the new language, and I'd like to state my rationale.
All right, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the testifier just said, comprehensive plans are developed every 10 years in current market, in current the way things move and change, they can get outdated really quickly. As we look to reduce the amount of revenue that we are sending to counties and cities, local governments, we need to not tie their hands in making good decisions for their municipalities. The two-thirds bar is a high bar for local elected officials to make good decisions. I don't know why we set that. And so I think, through a majority vote, let municipalities make decisions that are best for the people they serve.
Representative Hornstein, to the amendment.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins. No, I think that this bill is narrowly focused on housing, and I think I think there's a valid point you raise about comp plans in general. And that's an important discussion. It's not one that we've really had in the context of this bill. I think there'd probably be other stakeholders that would want to weigh in, pro and con. Because that's a pretty major change, Representative Biskins, and I understand where you're coming from, but this was really crafted very narrowly to address the problem that exists with affordable housing. But it's an important point, but at this juncture, I think we want to keep this narrowly focused to this issue.
All right. Further discussion to the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Hornstein, to your bill.
Thank you, members. I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your hearing this bill, and I would ask for a positive vote.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one quick question. When I'm reading this language in particular here, and we're looking at the 30% of 60% of area median income, when you have rents, they're like this. This is subsidized rental units, I'm quite confident. So who pays the rest of the bill for this rent? I just thought it would be good to clear that up.
Representative Horns.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, this language is in here because it's the commonly referred to definition for affordable housing. And so, there's a variety of different ways in which rents are bought down, and a number of different vehicles that are used to, in terms of housing finance. But Mr. McHenry wants to lay out kind of the city's perspective on that. I'd appreciate it. But this is really in here, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, as a definition, not as a financing mechanism.
Yeah, and
Mr. McHenry.
And Mr. Chair, I would agree with Representative Hornstein. It's just the common definition that they're using for affordable housing.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just still think it's rather, wasn't why is the language in here? My question is, who pays the rest of the rent? And so I'm hearing a variety of things. Can you maybe just give me a few examples of who does pay the rest of the rent?
Well, there's the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. There are a variety of federal programs, the Section 202 program. There is a Section 8 program.
There are a variety of private foundations that are involved in this kind of effort. Even Habitat for Humanity, which supports this bill, brings resources to the table. So it's a real wide range of financing tools that are used.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think my only concern with this, your local government, I agree with Representative Biskins, do this for everything, let local government manage it. My only concern is that you could possibly increasing the costs as well by doing this. So, as always, these are competing issues, and that's all it for today.
All right. Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is a straightforward and solid bill. I appreciate your support.
Okay. Hornstein renews his motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Thiessen, there he is.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen, I will move that House File 2660 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, this legislation grew out of legislation we passed last year to come up with ways to address three problems: the challenge of innovating within state government agencies to allow them to take some more risks with coming up with new ideas about how to approach problems. There's been lots of different approaches among nonprofits to tackling problems, but a lack of coordination. And also, we've had a problem of bringing good ideas that work in small scale to larger scale, regionally or statewide, and also to stop poor ideas in the nonprofit sector that aren't really delivering results for us. We passed the legislation last year created a group that met four times with representatives from nonprofits, from state agencies, from foundations. And you have a report in your packets that's a result of that legislation. One of the interesting things that came out of that is foundations and nonprofits in Minnesota are really rethinking their relationship with state government. For a long time, they were very concerned not to supplant what they saw as public sector duties. And but that is changing a little bit, that they understand a need to partnership and more collaboration. What the bill does basically is... if you look at page 3 of the report, there's four bullet points there. The bill does three of those. It doesn't have any legislation saying we should earmark certain percentage of ongoing program funding, because that's a decision made on a case-by-case basis. But it creates a Minnesota Coalition for Innovation and Collaboration, which is basically a collaboration between nonprofit sector and state agency employees, not commissioners, but kind of on-the-ground level employees, to come together, talk about how we can improve processes, how we can improve the delivery of services. It creates a discretionary grant program that's matched by the private sector to seed innovative ideas. And it then does, then Article 2, it creates, it adds nonprofits to our current law that allows agencies and local governments to apply for waivers from administrative rules and procedural laws. And I do have a testifier who was a member of the task force that can testify briefly about this process.
All right. We're running very short, but welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Colleen Ebinger, and I'm a program director at Root Cause, which is a nonprofit research and consulting firm. And I lead our work with government. We work with the nonprofit, public, and business sectors, trying to bring them together to match resources with innovative and proven solutions to social problems. I lead our work with government, which is why I was asked to testify today. For several years, we have been working formally and informally with state and local governments, and now with the federal government, advising each on strategies to develop government-based initiatives that can spur social innovation, identify and spread the best solutions, and build cross-sector partnerships in order to finally move the dial on many issues where we've remained static over so much time. So just briefly, to give you a sense of what's going on around the country in some of these areas, the White House has recently launched an Office of Social Innovation, and the Corporation for National and Community Service just released an RFP for a social innovation fund that will provide $4 in funding for every $1 of federal funds. The Democratic Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, who's now the mayor-elect of New Orleans, he launched a statewide Office of Social Entrepreneurship, which harnesses the innovation that he saw in the nonprofit community in the wake of Katrina. For 20 years, funding on some of those issues had been increasing, and yet the social indicators were remaining the same. So he's looking at a different way to address these problems. Meanwhile, the Republican governor of Texas issued an executive order creating the One Star Foundation, Texas Center for Social Impact, which is charged with strengthening the nonprofit sector across the state through nonprofit capacity building, social innovation, research into best practices, and volunteerism and service. And in Ohio, the governor's Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiative started a social entrepreneurship initiative to support organizations providing workforce development to the hardest to employ and generating most of their revenue through earned income services. So as you're well aware, states profit on both sides of the balance sheet when they can get this group back on track to employment, both in social service cost savings and in tax revenue generation. So I know that some of this can come across as wonky or abstract at times, but briefly I just wanted to tell it. Story that kind of illustrates this point, which is a woman who named Catherine Freund, whose 2-year-old son was hit by a car. He was not killed. The driver was an elderly man who was no longer capable of driving safely. Instead of suing him or launching a vindictive crusade against older drivers, she looked at the problem and understood that he was driving because he had no other way to get where he needed to go, and that if he gave up his keys, he would be housebound. While incompetent drivers on the road are threat to public safety and they carry a measurable cost to society, society also bears a cost when seniors are shut in. We know that their health deteriorates, they're more likely to miss doctor's appointments, they become more inclined to depression, their children and family tend to miss work to care for them, lowering their productivity, local businesses suffer from the loss of customer base. So she devised a model that would provide rides to seniors in the way that was most like their own automobile. She relied largely on volunteer drivers. She recruited sponsorship from local businesses that stood to gain financially from seniors' increased mobility. She received donated cars from seniors who gave up their keys, and in return, they received ride credits. Volunteer drivers were able to stockpile ride credits and transfer them to their father or grandmother, or even save them up for their own future use. She created an organization that virtually solved the dual problem of unsafe driving by older Americans and immobility of those who've given up their keys. And her model was self-sustaining. She didn't rely on federal or local tax money. She didn't even need foundation money. She's now in approximately 16 cities nationwide. But there's one catch. In each place where she opened a new office, the initial support to get it off the ground, initial public offering, if you will, as the business community would call it was provided by government. Municipalities recruited her to come to their cities, invested taxpayer funds to launch it, and then within 3 to 5 years, they were able to back away and let the model run without any ongoing financial commitment. So in the long term, they save their community significant money, and even more important than the money, by supporting the ITN model, these communities saved lives by moving unsafe drivers to the passenger seat, and they enhanced the quality of life of countless family members who no longer had to fret about how or whether Dad would get to his doctor's appointment. So these are the kinds of stories that this bill would make possible for Minnesota. It's not about this old debate of big government or small government. It's about government that works, government embracing the most effective solutions, with each sector playing the role for which it is best suited. It's about making smart use of government money, viewing spending as an investment, and measuring the performance of organizations receiving government contracts to ensure that there's a real social impact. It's about solving problems for citizens. Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to speak to the bill and to other things.
Well, you were on it.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Question I have, Representative Thiessen, on page 2, section 2 appropriation, there's a blank line under the appropriation, and I don't see a fiscal note. Do you have comments on that, or is there someone here? I see someone is here from the Department of Administration might be able to speak to this, because I see they're being mandated to provide staff and a variety of other things.
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, that's why this is going to a finance committee. We're still working that out, and there has not been fiscal note, which we can't get until it gets referred to a finance committee.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I don't think there's anyone listed to testify. All those in favor of the motion to have House File 2660 be recommended to pass and be referred to finance signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Thiessen, your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 3055. And I will recommend that House File 3055 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this bill is really a cleanup of legislation we passed last year that came through this committee to start moving counties toward more collaboration and working together in delivering their human services. And it really is that. It's a cleanup bill. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
The A2 amendment,
if someone would.
I'll move the A2 amendment.
And before you adopt it, I do have two quick technical changes. On line 1.8, I think the word area should read authority. And on line 1.11, I think after 4 and before service, we should insert an A. The article, yeah.
I'm going to have Mr. Shepard make sure that these work. Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, those amendments do work. I apologize. This was a typographical error when I put the amendment together.
All right. So, Mr. Shepard, can you just go back over one more time the two changes?
Mr. Chair and members, on page 1, line 8, delete area and insert authority. And on page 1, line 11, after working 4, insert the word A.
All right. Everybody have it? I'll incorporate that into the A2 amendment, and then I'll move the A2 amendment. Any discussion, further discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Thiessen, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to kind of to highlight the four most substantive changes, I mean, these are largely, again, getting are technical. On page, let's see, be about page 7. So at the end of section 5, we're asking for a program evaluation by the legislative auditor after in 2014. I know that there's issues with it's only asking that happen. It's not dictating that it happen. But we do want some accountability coming back to see how this process is working. So that is in there. At the end of the bill, the last page, there's a process for establishing service delivery authority that does constitute somewhat of a change, but what it does is actually bring in the old legislation. You can see the language that was deleted at the end of the bill. This kind of streamlines that process, so where there's not as many steps in the process of getting one of these service delivery authorities established. The last subdivision there in the commission authority to seek waivers, it's again the ability to, instead of basically what this is saying is that counties can seek waivers from the Legislative Advisory Committee. It's actually saying they can go to this board that we set up to establish these service delivery authorities instead of going to the Legislative Advisory Committee. And that really are the substantive changes. The rest of it is just to make this process work better. And I guess the last thing I would say is, since we've adopted this bill, which does two things, it sets up a process of saying instead of having all these guidances in Health and Human Services, which the state kind of prescribes exactly how counties have to do the work, we're going to move to a model where the state is setting expectations and accountability measures and letting counties figure out how best to meet those goals. That process is going ahead, and Representative Laughlin has been working on that, and we've actually been making some good progress in that direction. The other thing it does is sets up this board to allow these counties to come together, and the counties are saying that there's actually, although we haven't had any one of these service delivery authorities established yet, there's been a lot of very exciting work going on and moving in that direction, and I think in the next year we'll actually see the fruits of that work coming together, so we're going to have some administrative efficiencies and innovation getting built into how counties deliver human services. So I think this process is moving ahead effectively. This just makes it easier to move forward.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen. In regards to page 3, there's some stricken language on 3.21 down to 3.26 having to do with a system for reporting on the performance measures and goals. And it was rather really specific. It seemed to be some good goals that are here. And so if you could just address that particular area, maybe it is somewhere else because there's a lot of language added and stricken.
Representative Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer. I agree with you, and this is something that I thought was very important because what it does is matches resources with the goals. It actually, if you look on the last page, in subdivision 3, I think it is, and I hope that I'm right, that as they come forward with their proposal to the state, so this is something the commissioner and the counties have to agree to, there will be an agreement in the agreement, this memorandum of understanding governing the service delivery authority that actually sets that forth about what the resources and goal expectations are going to be. So we've tried to incorporate that idea in a different place that seems to work to get better procedurally.
Right, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say the goal, yes, I see that. But in this particular thing, it was a report to the legislature in particular that this is stricken information. So it isn't that the goals are there somewhere else, but it is a fact that this is language stricken from the report to the legislature.
Representative Teason.
Mr. Chair, the report to the legislature are this process that Representative Loeffler is working on about these recommendations for setting expectations and accountability. It became difficult to tie in the exact resource allocation that was going to be attached with each of these goals. So, I mean, the original language, the idea that I would have liked to go forward with is this notion, and I'm sorry to take up time, Mr. Chair, but I'll go as quickly as I can, was to say if we're going to set expectations, we should tie that to a certain amount of money, and if the amount of money goes down, counties should be expected to meet a lower level of expectations. That was the original idea. That is becoming very problematic to put into a statutory framework, and so instead we decided to try to address that as these service delivery authorities come forward on a more of a case-by-case basis, because what the idea of the service delivery authority is to break out of that model of the state's going to dictate everything, and it will actually be an agreement between this group of counties and the state that's more flexible. So you would say, we're going to meet these expectations and have this set of accountability, but we're going to need these kind of resources and cooperation from the state, and we're not going to proceed unless we get an agreement that moves in that direction. So it's a little bit more flexible way to get where we need to get. Ultimately, the goal of these things, and I don't think any are going to be improved unless they're actually going to be spending less money to meet the same needs. So,
right. Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3055... be adopted amendment. All right, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Gardner, House File 2510. Representative Gardner, I'll move that House File 2510 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Gardner, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment, the A10-2311.
All right, I'll move the A10-2311. Why don't you tell us what that does?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tell us what the amendment does.
Oh, very good. Mr. Chair, this clarifies what we're trying to do in a more precise way and adds the effective date and changes the title, and it lines it up with the Senate language.
All right. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Gardner, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the attachments you should have in your packet is a one-page article from the White Bear Lake Press that came out last year. The issue to be addressed here is that in a local election, and we assume that this could happen in other elections as well, several candidates for a city council were threatened anonymously with reprisal if they chose to run. And my senator, Senator Rummel, who represents White Bear Lake, did a little investigation, and local officials said that there was nothing technically illegal about it, even though we have a coercion statute. What the bill does is essentially puts in a pointer in Section 211B.10 to pretty much say that inducing or refraining anyone from running actually is coercion, and it points to the coercion statute. So you could bribe somebody to run, but there's nothing that says you can't threaten somebody not to run.
Representative Gardner, let's not open too many doors.
Okay.
One is enough.
Very good.
Members, to the bill is amended. Representative Gardner, you have anyone that wishes to testify? I don't have anyone on my list.
No, Mr. Chair. I know you're busy, so we didn't want to overwhelm you.
I'll renew my motion that House File 2510, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler, House File 1531.
Thank you,
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members, and I have an A3 amendment. I'd appreciate someone
moving. Hang on 1 second, Representative Loeffler. Let me move House File 1531 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to civil justice, so the bill's before us. Then you have an amendment, the A3 amendment. I'll move the A3 amendment, and then we'll get that on the bill for you so the bill's in order. So all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Loeffler, to your bill now as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill has to do with access to the quality information we need to do our job as informed policymakers. And what it does is it makes it clear that classified employees are to be nonpartisan resources to both the legislative and the executive branch and use their best information to assist us in making our decisions. And that workload concerns are to be balanced by management to make sure that they're still able to do their important work that we've hired them to do. And it provides whistleblower protection if they provide information that they believe to be accurate to state decision makers so that they cannot be disciplined for that. And the reason for this bill is I began my career actually as a state employee working on education policy, and at that time I believed I and all of my fellow workers were really trying just to help the state do good policy work and do the best that we could in our area of responsibility. And I think that's still the case, but there's been sort of a growing concern that a perception that a member of the state agency is a member of the, quote, executive's team as opposed to the legislative team, and that there's some act of disloyalty in helping us with our information, or that they're not allowed to assist legislators in the same way that they might assist the executive. And this just clarifies for information purposes that they are to respond to us appropriately. If I've called and asked for information questions and had state agency staff tell me I'm not allowed to talk to legislators, and it takes a week to get information long past the hearing for which that information would have been relevant, has passed. And with that, I'll be glad to respond to questions.
Questions? Seeing no questions, then I'll renew my motion that House File 1531 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to civil justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Poppy.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to move the minutes of March 11th.
All right. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.